"It would give the Sultan a strange appearance among the ranks of rulers," Lawrence said, only just contriving to present an appearance of equanimity. "To tolerate the disappearance of £500,000 meant for his treasury, and the death of an ambassador within his territory, with no inquiry. Mere courtesy to an ally would dictate greater concern, sir, at the circumstances which you have described to me."
"But, Captain, I assure you, all inquiries are being made," Mustafa said in great earnest, and tried to press a platter of honey-soaked pastry upon him.
Mustafa had at last appeared shortly after the hour of noon, pleading as excuse for his absence an unexpected affair of state which had drawn away his attention. By way of apology, he had come accompanied by their dinner, and an extravagant entertainment besides. 2 dozen servants or more bustled around with great noise, setting rugs and cushions for them upon the terrace, all around the marble pool, and ferrying great platters from the kitchens laden with fragrant pilaf, and heaps of mashed aubergines, cabbage leaves, and green peppers stuffed with meat and rice, skewers and thin-sliced roasted meats redolent of rich smoke. Temeraire, his head craned over the railing to observe the event, sniffed these with especial appreciation, and despite having been well fed on 2 tender lambs only an hour earlier, surreptitiously cleared in a few bites a serving dish set down for a moment within his reach, and left the servants staring at the empty platter, its gold scraped and dented by his teeth. In case this should have proved inadequate distraction, Mustafa had brought with him musicians, who at once set up a great noise, and a crowd of dancing girls in loose and translucent pantaloons. Their gyrations were so plainly indecent, and so little concealed by the veils which they swung round themselves, that Lawrence could only blush for them, though their performance was much applauded by many of his younger officers. The riflemen were the most outrageous. Portis had learnt his lesson, at least, but Dunn and Hackley, younger and more exuberant, were comporting themselves shamelessly, trying to catch at the trailing veils and whistling approval. Dunn even went so far as to get up onto one knee and reach out a hand before Lieutenant Riggs caught his ear smartly and pulled him down. Lawrence was in no danger of being so led astray. The women were beautiful, white-limbed and dark-eyed Circassians, but his wrath at these plain efforts to keep them from business was rather more enforced than any other base emotion, and superseded any temptation he might otherwise have felt. But when he tried at first to speak to Mustafa, one went so far as to approach him more directly, her arms spread wide to display her lovely breasts to good effect, these being covered inadequately and moving in counterpoint to her hips. Gracefully she seated herself upon his couch and stretched her slender arms out towards him in blatant invitation, an effective bar to any conversation, and it was no part of his character to thrust a woman forcibly away. Fortunately his virtue had an effective guardian. Temeraire put his head down to inspect her with jealous suspicion, eyes narrowing further at her many dazzling chains of gold, and snorted. The girl, unprepared for such a reception, sprang hurriedly up from the divan and back to the safety of her fellows. At last Lawrence was able to press Mustafa for some relief, only to have the Pasha put him off with vague assurances that the investigations would bear fruit.
"Soon, very soon, of course, although the labours of government are many, Captain, I am certain you understand."
"Sir," Lawrence said bluntly, "I understand well enough you may drag things out to suit you, but when you have delayed too long and rendered all discussion moot, what hold you presently have on our patience will be gone, and you may find such treatment will merit an answer you will not enjoy receiving." This pointed remark was as near as he felt he could come to a threat, or ought to. No minister of the Sultan's could fail to understand how very vulnerable the city was to blockade, or even attack by sea, with the navy in easy striking distance at Malta. Indeed, for once Mustafa was left without a ready answer, and his mouth was pressed tight.
"I am no diplomat, sir," Lawrence added, "and I cannot wrap my meaning up in fine language. When you know as well as do I that time is of the essence, and yet I am left to cool my heels to no purpose, I do not know what to call it but deliberate. And I cannot easily believe that my ambassador dead and his secretary missing, all his staff should have unceremoniously departed, though knowing to expect us, and with so vast a sum unaccounted for."
But to this Mustafa sat up and spread his hands.
"How may I convince you, Captain? Will you be satisfied to visit his residence and inspect for yourself?"
Lawrence paused, taken aback. His intention had been to press Mustafa for just such a liberty, and he had not expected to have it offered him unsolicited.
"I would indeed be glad of the opportunity," he answered, "and to speak with whatever servants of his household remain in the neighbourhood."
"I do not like it in the least," Granby said,
when a pair of mute guards arrived shortly after their dinner to escort Lawrence on the foray.
"You ought to remain here. Let me go instead, with Martin and Digby, and we will bring back anyone I can find."
"They are not likely to permit you to bring men freely into the palace, nor can they be so lost to reason as to murder us in the street with Temeraire and 24 men here to carry away the news," Lawrence said. "We will do very well."
"I do not like your going away either," Temeraire said discontentedly. "I do not see why I cannot come."
He had grown used to walking about freely in Peking, and so long as they had been in the wilderness, of course, his movements also had not been restricted.
"I am afraid the conditions here are not as they were in China," Lawrence said. "The streets of Istanbul will not admit of your passage, and if they did, we would begin a panic among the populace. Now, where is Mr. Tharkey?"
There was a moment of general silence and confusion, heads turning all around. Tharkey was nowhere to be seen. A hurried questioning made sure that no one had seen him since the previous evening, and then Digby pointed out his small bedroll, neatly tucked away and still bound up among their baggage, unused. Lawrence regarded it with a tight-lipped expression.
"Very well. We cannot delay in hopes he will come back. Mr. Granby, if he returns, you will put him under guard until I have opportunity to speak with him."
"Yes, sir,"
Granby said darkly. Certain phrases which might form a part of that conversation sprang forcefully to Lawrence's mind as he stood in bafflement outside the elegant ambassador's residence. The windows tight shuttered, the door barred, dust and rat droppings beginning to collect upon the front stoop. The guards only looked at him uncomprehendingly when he tried to make gestures suggesting the servants, and though he went so far as to apply at the neighbouring houses, he found no one who understood a word of English or French, nor even his wretched, gasping scraps of Latin.
"Sir,"
Digby said, low, when Lawrence came back unsuccessful once more from the third house,
"I think that window on the side there is unlocked, but I dare say I could scramble in if Mr. Martin would give me a leg up."
"Very good. Only mind you do not break your neck," Lawrence said.
He and Martin together heaved Digby up close enough to reach the balcony. Squirreling up over an iron railing was no great difficulty for a boy raised to clamber all over a dragon's back in mid-flight, and though the window stuck halfway, the young ensign was still slim enough he could wriggle through. The guards made an uneasy, wordless protest when Digby opened the front door from within, but Lawrence ignored them and went inside, Martin at his back. They stepped over straw and tracked dirt in the hallway, marks of bare, dusty feet on the floor, signs of a hasty packing and departure. Inside, the rooms were dark and echoing, even when the shutters were thrown open, sheets draped across furnishings all left in place, the ghostly quality of a house abandoned and waiting, and the low, muttering tick-tick of the great clock beside the staircase queerly loud in the hush. Lawrence went upstairs and through the chambers, but though there were some papers scattered and left here and there, these were little more than scraps left from packing, torn rags and fragments of kindling paper. One leaf he found beneath the writing-desk in a large bedchamber in a lady's hand, an excerpt of a cheerful and ordinary letter home, full of news of her small children and curious stories of the foreign city, broken off mid-page and never finished. He put it down again, sorry to have intruded. A smaller chamber down the hall, Lawrence thought, must have been Yarmouth's. It seemed as though the occupant had stepped out only for an hour. Two coats hanging with a clean shirt, a suit of evening wear, a pair of buckled shoes, a bottle of ink and a pen lying trimmed upon the desk, with books left on the shelves and a small cameo left inside the desk. A young woman's face. But the papers had been taken away, or at least there were none left which had any useful intelligence. He went down again, none the wiser, and Digby and Martin had met with no better luck below stairs. At least there was no sign of foul play, or of looting, though everywhere an untidy mess and all the furniture left behind. They had gone in a great hurry, certainly, but not, it seemed, by force. Her husband so suddenly dead, and his secretary vanished, under such irregular circumstances, and with so vast a sum of gold involved. Caution alone might have reasonably driven the ambassador's wife to take her children and the remains of her household and retreat, rather than remain alone and friendless in a city so foreign and far away from allies. But a letter to Vienna might take weeks to go and bring back a reply. They would not have time to learn the truth, not before the egg was irretrievably lost to them, and there was certainly nothing here to disprove Mustafa's story. Disheartened, Lawrence left the house, the guards beckoning them impatiently on, and Digby barred the door again from within and scrambled down from the balcony to rejoin them.
"Thank you, gentlemen. I think we have learned all we can," Lawrence said.
There was no sense in letting Martin and Digby share in his own sense of dismay, and as best he could he concealed his anxiety as they followed in the guards' train back towards the river. Yet he was deep in a brown study, and gave little attention to their surroundings but to watch they did not lose the guards in the enormous crowd. The ambassador's residence had stood in the Beoglu quarter across the Golden Horn, full of foreigners and tradesmen. There was a great press of people in the streets, strangely narrow after the broad avenues of Peking, and a din of voices calling, merchants outside their storefronts beckoning the instant they caught the eye of any passer-by, trying to draw them inside. But the crowd fell abruptly off, and the noise with it as they came nearer to the shore. Houses and shops all shuttered together, though now and again Lawrence saw a face look out momentarily from behind a curtain, peering up at the sky, then vanish again as quickly. Above them broad shadows flickered by, blotting out for a moment the sun, dragons wheeling overhead, so near their bellmen could be counted by the head. The guards looked up apprehensively and hurried them onward, though Lawrence would have liked to stop for a better look to see what they were about, lingering over so populous an area, and so crushing all the commerce of the day. Only a handful of men were to be seen in the streets beneath the shadows of the dragons, and those hurrying by anxious and quick. One dog stood barking with more courage than sense, its piercing voice carrying across the expanse of the harbour. The dragons paid it no more notice than a man might a buzzing fly, calling to one another aloft. Their chief ferryman was waiting uneasily, passing the end of his anchor cable through his hands, on the verge, perhaps, of abandoning them. He beckoned hurriedly while they came down the hill. Lawrence turned himself around in the boat to see as they drew away across the river. At first he thought the dragons, perhaps half a dozen of them, were only sporting in the air. But then he saw there were thick cables stretching down over the harbour, and the dragons were hauling upon these, drawing up whole wagons which carried, unmistakable, the barrels of long guns. When they had reached the far shore of the river, Lawrence leapt out ahead of the guards and went to the dockside to look more closely. Already he could tell these were no trivial works. A host of low-bellied barges stood in the harbour, swarmed with some hundreds of men arranging the next wagon-loads, and a crowd of horses and mules somehow being kept obedient despite the dragons so nearby. Perhaps because the dragons were above and out of their direct sight. Not only guns, but cannonballs, barrels of powder, heaps of brick. Such a mass of material, Lawrence would have allowed weeks to shift it up the steep hill, all of it travelling upwards quick as winking. And higher upon the hillside itself the dragons were lowering the massive cannon barrels into their waiting wooden cradles, as easily as a pair of men might move a plank of wood. Lawrence was by no means the only curious observer. A great press of natives of the city were gathered along the docks, staring at the scene and whispering amongst themselves doubtfully. A company of Janissaries, in their plumed helmets, stood frowning not a dozen yards away, with their hands restless and toying with their carbines. One enterprising young man was going about offering the use of a glass to the onlookers for a small fee. It was not very powerful, and the lenses mazed, but good enough for a closer look.
96 pounders, unless I quite mistake it. Maybe so many as 20 of them. And I think there were as many more already ensconced on the Asian coast. This harbour will be a death-trap for any ship that comes in range, Lawrence said grimly to Granby, as he washed the dust of the streets from his face and hands in the basin set on the wall, and ducked his head in the water for good measure, wringing his hair out with some savagery. Soon he would resort to hacking off the ends with his sword, he thought, if he did not come to a barber. It had always refused to grow long enough for a proper queue, only enough to be an irritation and drip endlessly when wet. And they were not at all sorry to let me see it. Those guards were urging us along all the day, but they were pleased enough for me to stop and stare as long as I liked. "Mustafa might as well have thumbed his nose at us," Granby agreed. "And Lawrence, I'm afraid that is not the only—well, You will see for yourself.
And together they went around to the garden side. The Kazilik dragons had gone, but in their stead another dozen dragons had been set around Temeraire, so that the garden was grown crowded, and a couple of them were obliged even to perch atop the backs of others.
"Oh, no, they are all quite friendly, and have only come to talk," Temeraire said earnestly.
He was already making himself understood somehow in a mélange of French scattered with Turkish and the dragon language, and with some labour and repetition he presented Lawrence to the Turkish dragons, who all nodded their heads to him politely.
"They will still give us no end of difficulty if we need to leave with any haste," Lawrence said, eyeing them sidelong.
Temeraire was fast, very fast, for a dragon of his size, but the couriers at least could certainly outdistance him, and Lawrence rather thought a couple of the middleweight beasts might be able to match his speed long enough to slow him for a dragon more up to his fighting weight. But they were at least not unpleasant guard dogs, and proved informative.
"Yes, some of them have been telling me about the harbour works. They are here in the city helping," Temeraire said,
when the operations Lawrence had seen were described to him, and the visiting dragons willingly confirmed a good deal of what Lawrence had surmised. They were fortifying the harbour with a great many cannon.
"It sounds very interesting. I would like to go and see if we might."
"I would dearly like a closer look myself," Granby said. "I have no idea how they are managing it with horses involved. It is the very devil of a time having cattle around dragons. We count ourselves lucky not to stampede them, much less to get any useful work out of them. It is not enough to keep them out of sight. A horse can smell a dragon more than a mile off."
"I doubt Mustafa will be inclined to let us inspect their works very closely," Lawrence said. "To let us have a glimpse across the harbour to impress upon us the futility of attack is one thing. To show all his hand would be something else. Has there been any word from him, any further explanation?"
"Not a peep, and neither hide nor hair of Tharke either, since you left," Granby said.
Lawrence nodded and sat down heavily upon the stairs.
"We cannot keep going through all these ministers and official channels," he said finally. "Time is too short. We must demand an audience with the Sultan. His intercession must be the surest way to gain their quick cooperation. But if he has let them put us off this far—" "I cannot credit an intention on his part to wreck all relations," Lawrence said. "Not with Bonaparte nearer his doorstep than ever since Austerlitz. And if he would be as pleased to keep the eggs, that is not as much to say he would choose them over an open and final breach. But so long as his ministers serve as intercessionaries, he has not committed himself and his state. He can always blame it upon them. If indeed it is not some sort of private political tangle behind these delays to begin with."
Chapter 7 Lawrence occupied his evening with writing a fresh letter, this one still more impassioned and addressed directly to the Grand Vizier. He was only able to dispatch it by the cost of 2 pieces of silver instead of 1. The boy servant had grown conscious of the strength of his position, and kept his hand outstretched firmly when Lawrence put the first piece into his palm, staring silent but expectantly until Lawrence at last set another down. An impudence Lawrence was powerless to answer otherwise. The letter brought no answer that night, but in the morning, at first he thought he had at last won some reply, for a tall and impressive man came walking briskly and with energy into their courtyard shortly past first light, trailed by several of the black eunuch guards. He created something of a noise, and then came out to the gardens where Lawrence was sitting with Temeraire and labouring over yet another letter. The newcomer was plainly a military officer of some rank, an aviator by his long sweeping coat of leather gorgeously embroidered around the borders, and by the short-trimmed hair that set the Turkish aviators apart from their turbaned fellows, and a gifted one by the sparkling jewelled chelenk upon his chest, a singular mark of honour among the Turks, rarely bestowed, which Lawrence recognised from its having been granted Lord Nelson after the victory of the Nile. The officer mentioned Bezaid's name, which made Lawrence suspect him the Kazilik male's captain, but his French was not good, and at first Lawrence thought he was speaking over loud to try and make himself understood. He went on at length, his words tumbling together, and turned to address the watching dragons noisily also.
"But I have not said anything that is not the truth," Temeraire said indignantly,
and Lawrence, still puzzling out the words he had managed to pick out of the flood, realized the officer was deeply, furiously agitated, and his spitting words rather a sign of high temper than inarticulate speech. The officer actually shook his fist in Temeraire's teeth and said to Lawrence violently in French,
"He tells more lies, and—"
Here he dragged his hand across his throat, a gesture requiring no translation. Having finished this incoherent speech, he turned and stormed out of the garden, and in his wake a handful of the dragons sheepishly leapt into the air and flew away. Plainly they were not under any orders to guard Temeraire at all.
"Temeraire,"
Lawrence said in the following silence,
"what have you been saying to them?"
"I have only been telling them about property," Temeraire said, "and how they ought to be paid, and not need to go to war unless they wish it, but might do more work such as they are doing upon the harbour, or some other sort of labour which might be more interesting, and then they could earn money for jewels and food, and go about the city as they liked."
"Oh, good God," Lawrence said with a groan.
He could imagine very well how these communications would have been viewed by a Turkish officer whose dragon expressed a desire not to go into battle, and to take up some other profession, which Temeraire might have suggested from his experience in China, such as poetry or nursemaiding.
"Pray send the rest of them away at once, or I dare say every officer of the Turkish corps in reach will come and rail at us in turn."
"I do not care if they do," Temeraire said obstinately. "If he had stayed, I should have had a great deal to say to him. If he cared for his dragon, he would want him treated well, and to have liberty."
"You cannot be proselytizing now," Lawrence said. "Temeraire, we are guests here, and very nearly supplicants. They can deny us the eggs and make all our work to come here quite useless, and surely you see that they are putting obstacles enough in our path without we give them any further cause to be difficult. We must rather conciliate the goodwill of our hosts than offend them."
"Why ought we conciliate the men at the dragon's expense?" Temeraire said. "The eggs are theirs, after all. And indeed, I do not see why we are not negotiating with them, rather."
"They do not tend their own eggs, or manage their hatching. You know they have left the eggs to their captains and given over their handling," Lawrence said. "Else I should be delighted to address them. They could scarcely be less reasonable than our hosts," he added with some frustration. "But as matters stand, we are at the mercy of the Turks, and not their dragons."
Temeraire was silent, though his tail, twitching rapidly, betrayed his agitation.
"But they have never had the opportunity to understand their own condition, nor that there might be a better. They are as ignorant as I myself was before I saw China, and if they do not learn that much, how would anything ever change?"
"You will accomplish no change solely by making them discontented and offending their captains," Lawrence said. "But in any case, our duty to home and to the war effort must come first. A Kazilik alone on our side of the Channel may mean the difference between invasion and security, and tip the balance of war. We can hardly weigh any concerns against such a potential advantage."
"But—"
He stopped, and scratched at his forehead with the side of his claw.
"But how will matters at all be different once we are at home? If men will be upset at giving dragons liberty, would this not interfere with the war in England too, and not only by keeping us from the eggs here? Or if some British dragons did not want to fight any more, that would hurt the war also."
He peered down with open curiosity at Lawrence, waiting an answer which Lawrence could not give, for indeed he felt precisely so, and he could not lie and say otherwise, not in the face of a direct question. He could think of nothing to say which would satisfy Temeraire, and as his silence stretched, Temeraire's ruff slowly drooped down, flattening against his neck, and his tendrils hung limply.
"You do not want me to say these things when we are at home, either," Temeraire said quietly. "Have you only been humouring me? You think it is all foolishness, and we ought not make any demands."
"No, Temeraire," Lawrence said very low, "not foolishness at all. You have all the right in the world to liberty. But selfish? Yes, I must call it so."
Temeraire flinched and drew his head back a little, bewildered. Lawrence looked down at his own tight-wrung hands. There could be no softening of it now, and he must pay for his long delay of the inevitable at a usurious rate of interest.
"We are at war," he said, "and our case is a desperate one. Against us is ranged a general who has never been defeated, at the head of a country with twice over and more the native resources of our own small British Isles. You know Bonaparte has once massed an invasion force. He can do it again.
If only he should subdue the continent to his satisfaction, and perhaps with more success in a second attempt. In such circumstances, to begin a campaign for private benefit, which should have material risks of injuring the war effort, in my opinion, can bear no other name. Duty requires we put the concerns of the nation above our own.
But, Temeraire protested, in a voice as small as could be produced from his deep chest, but it is not for my own benefit, but for that of all the dragons that I wish to press for change.
If the war be lost, what will anything else matter, or whatever progress you have made at the expense of such a loss? Lawrence said. Bonaparte will tyrannize over all Europe, and no one will have any liberty at all, men or dragons.
Temeraire made no answer. His head drooped over his forelegs, curling in on himself.
"I beg you, my dear, only to have patience," Lawrence said, after a long and painful moment of silence, aching to see him so downcast, and wishing he might in honesty recall his own words. "I do promise you, we will make a beginning. Once we are home in England, we will find friends who will listen to us, and I hope I may have some small influence to call upon also. There are many real advances," he added a little desperately, "practical improvements which can be made without any unhappy effect upon the progress of the war, and with these examples to open the way, I am confident you will soon find a happier reception for your more lavish ideas, a better success at the cost only of time."
"But the war must come first," Temeraire said, low.
"Yes," Lawrence said. "Forgive me. I would not for the world give you pain."
Temeraire shook his head a little and leaned over to nuzzle him briefly.
"I know, Lawrence," he said, and rose up to go and speak to the other dragons, who were still gathered behind them in the garden, watching. And when he had seen them all flit away again, he padded away with head bowed low, to curl himself brooding in the shade of the cypress trees.
Lawrence went inside and sat watching him through the window lattice, wondering wretchedly if Temeraire would have been happier after all to stay the rest of his days in China.
"You could tell him,"
Granby said, but he stopped and shook his head.
"No, it won't do," he agreed. "I'm damn sorry, Lawrence, but I can't see how you can sweeten it. You would not credit the stupid display in Parliament any time we ask for funds only to keep up a covert or two, or get some better provisions for them. Even if we only start building them pavilions, we will have a second war at home on our hands, and that is the least of his notions."
Lawrence looked at him.
"Will it hurt your chances?" he asked quietly.
These could not be very good in any case, with more than a year so far from home, out from under the eye of the senior officers who decided which lieutenants should be allowed a chance to put a hatchling into harness, not with 10 eager men or more to every egg.
"I hope I'm not so selfish a dog as to cavil for a reason such as that," Granby said with spirit. "I never knew a fellow to get an egg who was forever worrying about it. Pray don't consider it. Damn few fellows who come into the corps fresh, like me, ever get their step. There are too many dragons who go by inheritance, and the admirals like to have fellows from corps families. But if I ever have a boy, now I am far enough along I can give him a leg up, or one of my nephews. That is good enough for me, and serving with a prime goer like Temeraire."
But he could not quite keep a wistful note from his voice. Of course he would want his own dragon, and Lawrence was certain that service as first lieutenant aboard a heavyweight like Temeraire would ordinarily have meant a very good opportunity. Consideration for Granby was not an argument which could be made to Temeraire himself, of course, being a wholly unfair sort of pressure. On Lawrence, however, it weighed heavily. He had been himself the beneficiary of a great deal of influence in his naval service, much of it even earned by merit, and he considered it a point of honour to do properly by his own officers. He went outside. Temeraire had retreated further within the gardens. When Lawrence at last came on him, Temeraire was still sitting, curled quietly, his distress betrayed only by the furrows which he had gouged deep in the ground before him. His head was lowered upon his forelegs, and his eyes distant and narrow-slitted, the ruff nearly flat against his neck, sorrowful. Lawrence had no very clear notion of what to say, only wishing desperately to see him less unhappy, and almost willing to lie again if it would not hurt him the more. He stepped closer, and Temeraire lifted his head and looked at him. They neither of them spoke, but he went to Temeraire's side and put his hand on him, and Temeraire made a place in the crook of his foreleg for Lawrence to sit. A dozen nightingales were singing, pent in some nearby aviary. No other sound disturbed them a long while, and then Emily came running through the garden and calling,
"Sir, sir!"
Until panting she reached them and said, "Sir, pray come, they want to take Dun and Hackley and hang them." Lawrence stared, leapt down from Temeraire's arm, and dashed back up the stairs to the court, Temeraire sitting up and putting his head anxiously over the terrace railing. Nearly all the crew were out in the arched cloister, figuring in a wild, noisy struggle with their own door guards and several other palace eunuchs, men of far greater position, judging by their golden-hilted scimitars and rich garb, and of more powerful mien, bull-necked and plainly not mutes, with furious imprecations flying from their lips as they wrestled slighter aviators to the ground. Dun and Hackley were in the thick of it. The two young riflemen were panting and fighting against the grip of the heavy-set men who clutched at them.
"What the devil do you all mean by this?" Lawrence bellowed, and let his voice carry over their heads.
Temeraire added emphasis with his own rumbling growl, and the struggle subsided. The aviators fell back, and the guards stared up at Temeraire with expressions to suggest they would have gone pale if they could. They did not loose their captives, but at least did not attempt at once to drag them away.
"Now then," Lawrence said grimly, "what goes toward here, Mr. Dunn?"
He and Hackley hung their heads and said nothing, an answer in itself. Plainly they had engaged in some sort of skylarking and disturbed the guards.
"Go and fetch Hassan Mustafa Pasha,"
Lawrence said to one of their own guards, a fellow he recognized, and repeated the name a few times over, the man glancing reluctantly at the others. Abruptly, one of the stranger eunuchs, a tall and imposing man in a high turban, snow-white against his dark skin and adorned by a sizable ruby set in gold, spoke commandingly to the guard. At this, the mute at last nodded and set off down the stairs, hurrying away towards the rest of the palace grounds. Lawrence turned around.
"You will answer me, Mr. Dunn, at once."
"Sir, we didn't mean any harm," Dunn said. "We only thought... we thought..."
He looked at Hackley, but the other rifleman was dumb and staring, pale under his freckled skin. No help.
"We only went up over the roof, sir, and then we thought we might have a look round at the rest of the place, and then those fellows started chasing us, and we got over the wall again and ran back here and tried to get back inside."
"I see," Lawrence said coldly. "And you thought you would do this without application to myself or Mr. Granby, as to the wisdom of this course of action?"
Dunn swallowed and let his head fall again. There was an uneasy, uncomfortable silence, a long wait, but not so very long before Mustafa came around the corner at a rapid clip, the guard leading him, and his face red and mottled with haste and anger.
"Sir,"
Lawrence said, forestalling him,
"my men without permission left their posts. I regret that they should have caused a disturbance."
"You must hand them over," Mustafa said. "They shall at once be put to death. They attempted to enter the seraglio."
Lawrence said nothing a moment, while Dunn and Hackley hunched themselves still lower and darted their eyes at his face anxiously.
"Did they trespass upon the privacy of the women?"
"Sir, we never—" Dunn began.
"Be silent,"
Lawrence said savagely. Mustafa spoke to the guards. The chief eunuch beckoned forward one of his men, who answered in a voluble flow.
"They looked in upon them, and made to them beckoning gestures through the window," Mustafa said, turning back. "More than sufficient insult. It is forbidden that any man but the Sultan should look upon the women of the harem and have intercourse with them. Only the eunuchs otherwise may speak with them."
Temeraire, listening to this, snorted forcefully enough to blow the fountain spray into their faces.
"That is very silly," he said hotly. "I am not having any of my crew put to death, and anyway I do not see why anyone should be put to death for talking to someone else at all. It is not as though that could hurt anyone."
Mustafa did not try to answer him, but instead turned a narrow, measured look on Lawrence.
"I trust you do not mean to thus defy the Sultan's law, Captain, and give offence. You have, I think, had something to say on the subject of courtesy between our nations before."
"On that subject, sir," Lawrence said,
angry at this bald-faced attempt at pressure, and then swallowed the words which leapt to his tongue. Such as a pointed remark that Mustafa had been quick enough to come at once on this occasion, though previous entreaties had found him so occupied he could not spare a moment. Instead he controlled himself and said after a moment,
"Sir, I think perhaps your guard may have from zeal thought more transpired than did in fact occur.
I dare say my officers did not see the women at all, but only were calling in hopes of catching sight of them. That is a great folly, and you may be sure, he added with heavy emphasis, that they will suffer punishment for it, but to hand them over to death for it I will not do, not on the word of a witness who has every cause to accuse them of doing rather more than less than they did, from a natural desire of protecting his charges from insult.
Mustafa, frowning, appeared ready to dispute further.
Lawrence added, "If they had outraged the virtue of any of the women, I would without hesitation deal with them according to your notion of justice, but so uncertain a circumstance, with a single witness to speak against them, must argue for a degree of mercy."
He did not move his hand to the hilt of his sword, nor signal to his men, but as best he could, without turning his head, he considered their positions, and the disposal of their baggage, most of which had been stowed away inside the kiosks. If the Turks wished to seize Dunn and Hackley by force, he should have to order the men aboard directly and leave all behind. If half a dozen dragons got into the air before Temeraire was aloft, it would be all up with them.
"Mercy is a great virtue," Mustafa said finally, "and indeed it would be sorrowful to mar relations between our countries by unhappy and false accusations. I am sure," he added, looking at Lawrence significantly, "that you would grant an equal presentiment of innocence in any reverse case."
Lawrence pressed his lips together.
"You may rely upon it," he said through his teeth, well aware he had committed himself to at least tolerate the inadequacies of the Turkish explanations so long as he had no proof of the reverse. But there was very little choice. He would not see two young officers under his care put to death for kissing their hands to a handful of girls through a window, dearly as he would have liked to wring their necks. Mustafa's mouth turned up at the corner, and he inclined his head.
"I believe we understand one another, Captain. We will leave their correction to you, then, and I trust you will ensure no similar incident occurs. Gentleness shown once is mercy, shown twice is folly."
He collected the guards and led them away into the grounds, not without some low and angry protest on their part. There were some sighs of relief as they at last reluctantly went out of sight, and a couple of the other riflemen went so far as to clap Dunn and Hackley on the back, behaviour which had at once to be stopped.
"That will be enough," Lawrence said dangerously. "Mr. Granby, you will note for the log that Mr. Dunn and Mr. Hackley are turned out of the flight crew, and you will put their names in the ground crew roll."
Lawrence had no very good idea whether an aviator might so be turned before the mast, as it were, but his expression did not allow of argument, and he did not receive any, only Granby's quiet,
"Yes, sir,"
a harsh sentence, and it would look ugly upon their records even after they had been restored to their positions, as Lawrence meant to do once they had learned a lesson. But he had little other choice if they were to be punished. He could call no court-martial here, so far from home, and they were too old to be started with a cane.
"Mr. Pratt, take these men in irons. Mr. Fellows, I trust our supply of leather will allow you to prepare a lash?"
"Aye, sir,"
Fellows said, clearing his throat uncomfortably.
"But Lawrence, Lawrence," Temeraire said into complete silence, the only one who would have dared intercede. "Mustafa and those guards have gone. You need not flog Dunn and Hackley now."
"They deserted their posts and wilfully risked all the success of our enterprise. All for the satisfaction of the most base and carnal impulses,"
Lawrence said flatly.
"No, do not speak further in their defence, Temeraire. Any court-martial would hang them for it, and high spirits make no excuse. They knew better."
He saw with some grim approval the young men flinching, and nodded shortly.
"Who was on guard when they left?" he asked, surveying the rest of the crew.
Eyes dropped all around. Then young Salyer stepped forward and said, "I was, sir," in a trembling voice which cracked mid-word.
"Did you see them go?"
Lawrence asked quietly.
"Yes, sir,"
Salyer whispered.
"Sir," Dunn said hurriedly, "sir, we told him to keep quiet, that it was only for a lark."
"That will be quite enough, Mr. Dunn,"
Granby said. Salyer himself did not make excuses, and he was indeed a boy, only lately made midwingman, though tall and gangly with his adolescent growth.
"Mr. Salyer, as you cannot be trusted to keep watch, you are reduced to ensign," Lawrence said. "Go and cut a switch from one of those trees and go to my quarters."
Salyer stumbled away, hiding his face, which beneath his hand was blotchy red. To Dunn and Hackley, Lawrence turned and said, 50 lashes each, and you may call yourselves damned lucky. Mr. Granby, we will assemble in the garden for punishment at the stroke of 11. See to it the bell is rung. He went to his kiosk, and when Salyer came, gave him 10 strokes. It was a paltry count, but the boy had foolishly cut the switch from springy green wood, far more painful and more like to cut the skin, and the boy would be humiliated if he was driven to weeping.
That will do. So you do not forget this, Lawrence said, and sent him away, before the trembling gasps had broken into tears.
Then he drew out his best clothes. He still had no better coat than the Chinese garment, but he set Emily to polish his boots fresh and Dyer to press his neckcloth, while he went out and shaved himself over the small hand-basin. He put on his dress sword and his best hat, then went out again and found the rest of the crew assembling in their Sunday clothing, and makeshift frames of bare signal flag shafts thrust deep into the ground. Temeraire hovered anxiously, shifting his weight from side to side and ploughing up the earth.
"I am sorry to ask it of you, Mr. Pratt, but it must be done," Lawrence said to the armourer quietly,
and Pratt, with his big head hung low between his shoulders, nodded once.
"I will keep the count myself. Do you not count aloud?"
"Yes, sir,"
Pratt said. The sun crept a little higher. All the crew were already assembled and waiting, and had been 10 minutes and more, but Lawrence neither spoke nor moved until Granby cleared his throat and said,
"Mr. Digby, ring the bell for 11, if you please,"
with great formality, and the 11 strokes tolled away, if softly. Stripped to the waist and in their oldest breeches, Dunn and Hackley were led up to the poles. They at least did not disgrace themselves, but silently put their shaking hands up to be tied. Pratt was standing unhappily 10 paces back, running the long strap of the whip through his hands, folding it upon itself every few inches. It looked like an old scrap of harness, hopefully softened by use, and much of the thickness worn away. Better, at any rate, than new leather.
"Very well," Lawrence said.
A terrible silence fell, broken only by the crack of the descending lash, the gasps and cries growing slowly fainter, the count going on and on with their bodies slackening in the frames, hanging heavy from their wrists and dripping thin trickles of blood. Temeraire keened unhappily and put his head under his wing.
"I make that 50, Mr. Pratt," Lawrence said.
Nearer to 40, if even so far, but he doubted any of his men had been counting very closely, and he was sick to his heart of the business. He had rarely ordered floggings of more than 12 strokes, even as a naval captain, and the practice was entirely less common among aviators. For all the gravity of the offence, Dunn and Hackley were still very young, and he blamed himself in no small part that they should have come to run so wild. Still, it had to be done. They had known better, much better, and been reined in scarcely days before. So flagrant a breach left unchecked would have wholly ruined them. Granby had not been so far off in Macau to worry about the effect of their long travels on the young officers. The long idleness of their sea journey, followed by their more recent excess of adventure, was no substitute for the steady pressure of ordinary day-to-day discipline in a covert. It was not enough for a soldier to be brave. Lawrence was not sorry to see a strong impression from the punishment on the faces of the other officers, particularly the young men, that at least this small good might come of the unhappy incident. Dunn and Hackley were cut down and carried not unkindly back up to the larger kiosk and laid in a screened-off corner upon a pair of cots which Keynes had prepared. They lay on their faces, still gasping softly in half-consciousness, while he with a tight mouth sopped away the blood from their backs and gave them each a quarter glass of laudanum to drink.
"How do they do?"
Lawrence asked the dragon surgeon later in the evening. They had fallen quiet after the drug and lain still.
"Well enough," Keynes said shortly. "I'm grown used to having them as patients. They had only just risen from their sick beds." "Mr. Keynes," Lawrence said quietly.
Keynes, looking up at his face, fell silent and turned his attention back to the wounded men.
"They are inclined to be a little feverish, but that is nothing wonderful. They are young and strong. The bleeding has stopped nicely. They ought to be on their feet by morning, for a little while in any case." "Very good," Lawrence said, and turned away to find Tharkey standing before him
in the low circle of the candlelight, looking at Dunn and Hackley where they lay. Their striped backs were bare, and the wheels bright red and purpling along the edges. Lawrence stared, drew in a sharp breath, then with controlled fury said,
"Well, sir, and do you return? I wonder you should show your face here again."
Tharkay said, "I hope my absence has not been too great an inconvenience," with calm impudence.
"Only of too short duration," Lawrence said. "Take your money and your things and get out of my sight, and I wish you may go to the devil."
"Well," Tharkay said after a moment, "if you have no further need of my services, I suppose I may as well be on my way. I will give Mr. Marden your apologies then, and indeed I ought not to have committed you."
"Who is Mr. Marden?"
Lawrence said, frowning. The name was distantly familiar, and then he slowly reached into his coat and drew out the letter which had come to them in Macau all those long months ago, which Tharkay had brought to him. Flaps still marked with seals, and one of those marked with a solid M.
"You are speaking of the gentleman who engaged you to bring us our orders?" he asked sharply.
"I am," Tharkay said. "He is a banker here in the city, and Mr. Arbuthnot desired him to find a reliable messenger for the letter. Alas, only I was to be had." There was a little mocking quality to his voice. "He invites you to dine. Will you come?"
Chapter 8
"Now," Tharkay said. Soft, soft. They were at the palace wall, and the night guards had just gone past. He flung a grappling line, and they scrambled up and over. No great trick for a sailor, the stone wall, ragged-faced and generous with footholds. In the outer gardens, pleasure pavilions stood overlooking the sea, and a single great towering column loomed up against the half-moon while they ran across the lawns. Then they were safely across the open ground and into the thickets left wild upon the hillside, ivy blanketing scraps of old, old ruins, arches built of brick and columns tumbled onto their sides. They had another wall to scramble over, but this one, travelling as it did all around the circumference of the vast grounds, was too long to be well patrolled. Then they made their way down to the shores of the Golden Horn, where Tharkay, calling softly, roused a ferryman to carry them across the span in his little damp boat. The tributary glimmered to match its name even in the darkness, reflections stretching long from window light and boat lanterns on both of its banks, people taking the air on balconies and terraces, and the sound of music carrying easily over the water. Lawrence would have liked to stop and look over the harbour for some closer detail of the works he had seen the previous day, but Tharkay led him on, without a pause, away from the dockyards and into the streets, not in the same direction as the embassy, but towards the ancient spire of Galata Tower, standing sentinel upon the hill. A low wall encircled the district around the watchtower, soft and crumbling, and very old, unattended. Inside the streets were much quieter, only a handful of coffee-houses owned by Greeks or Italians still lit, small handfuls of men at tables talking in low voices over cups of the sweet-smelling apple tea, and here and there a devoted hookah smoker gazing out upon the street while the fragrant steam emitted in slow, thin trails from between his lips. Avram Marden's house was handsome, wider by twice than its nearest neighbours, and framed by broad-spreading trees, established on an avenue with a clear prospect on the old tower. A maid welcomed them, and within were all the signs of prosperity and long residence, carpets old but rich and still bright, portraits upon the walls in gilt frames of dark-eyed men and women, rather more Spanish than Turkish in character, Lawrence would have said. Marden poured them wine, as the maid laid out a platter of thin bread with a dish of paste made from aubergines, very piquant, and another of sweet raisins and dates chopped together with nuts flavoured with red wine.
"My family came from Seville," he said, when Lawrence mentioned the portraits. "When the king and the Inquisition expelled us, the Sultan was kinder to us."
Lawrence hoped he might not have a very dismal meal ahead of him, having some vague impression of restrictions upon the Jewish diet, but the late dinner was more than respectable. A very good leg of lamb roasted to a turn in the Turkish manner, and carved off the spit into thin slices, with new potatoes dressed in their skins, and a fragrant glaze of olive oil and strong herbs, and besides a whole fish roasted with peppers and tomatoes, pungent and strongly flavoured with the common yellow spice, and a tenderly stewed fowl which no one could have objected to. Marden, who in his trade often served as a factor for British visitors, spoke excellent English, and his family also. They sat to table five, Marden's two sons being already established in their own homes. Besides his wife, only his daughter Sarah remained at home, a young woman well out of the schoolroom, not yet 30, but old to be unmarried with so good a dowry as Marden seemed able to provide, and her looks and manner were pleasing, if in a foreign mode, dark hair and brows striking against fair skin, very like her elegant mother. Seated opposite the guests, she from either modesty or shyness kept her eyes lowered, though she spoke easily enough when addressed in a self-possessed manner. Lawrence did not broach his urgent inquiries himself, feeling it a species of rudeness, but rather fell back on a description of their journey westward, prompted by his host's inquiries. These were polite to begin with, but soon began to be truly curious. Lawrence had been raised to consider it a gentleman's duty to make good dinner conversation, and their passage had furnished him with material enough for anecdotes to make it very little burden in the present case. With the ladies present, he made somewhat light of the worst dangers of the sandstorm and the avalanche, and did not speak of their encounter with the horsemen raiders. But there was interest enough without it.
"And then the wretches lighted on the cattle and were off again without a by your leave," he said, finishing ruefully with the account of the Ferrells' mortifying performance at the city gates, with that villain Arcady wagging his head at us as he went, and all of us left at a standstill, our mouths hanging open. They went back well pleased with themselves, I'm sure, and as for us, it is, of all things, wonderful we were not thrown into prison.
"A cold welcome for you, after a difficult road," Marden said, amused.
"Yes, a very difficult road," Sarah Marden said, in her quiet voice, without looking up. "I am glad you all came through in safety."
There was a brief pause in the conversation. Then Marden reached out and handed to Lawrence the bread platter, saying,
"Well, I hope you are comfortable enough now. At least in the palace you must not be subjected to all this noise we have."
He was referring to the construction in the harbour, evidently a source of much aggrievance.
"Who can get anything done with those great beasts overhead?" Mrs. Marden said, shaking her head. "Such a noise they make! And if they were to drop one of those cannon! Terrible creatures! I wish they were not let into civilized places, not to speak of your dragon, of course, Captain. I am sure he is beautifully behaved," she said hastily, catching herself and speaking apologetically to Lawrence with some confusion.
"I suppose we sound to you complainers over nothing, Captain," Marden said, coming to her rescue. "When you daily must tend to them at close quarters."
"No, sir," Lawrence said. "Indeed, I found it wonderful to see a flight of dragons in the middle of the city here. We are not permitted to come so near to settled places in England, and must follow particular courses to navigate overhead in the cities that we do not distress the populace or the cattle. And even then there is always something of a noise made about our movements. Temeraire has often found it a burdensome stricture. Then is it a new sort of arrangement?"
"Of course," Mrs. Marden said. "I never heard of such a thing before. And I hope I never do again when it is over with. Not a word of warning, either. They appeared one morning as soon as the call to prayer was over, and we were left quaking in our houses all the day."
"One grows accustomed," Marden said, with a philosophical shrug. "It has been a little slow the last 2 weeks, but the stores are opening again, dragons or no."
"Yes, and none too soon," Mrs. Marden said. "How we are to arrange everything in less than a month. Nadire," she called to the maid, "give me the wine, please,"
with only the barest pause, scarcely noticeable. The little maid came in and handed over the decanter, which stood in easy reach on the sideboard, and whisked herself out again. While the bottle went around, Marden said quietly, while he poured for Lawrence,
"My daughter is to be married soon."
He spoke in a queerly gentle tone, almost apologetic. An uncomfortable, waiting silence fell, which Lawrence did not understand. Mrs. Marden looked down at her plate, biting her lip. Tharkay broke it, lifting his glass, and said to Sarah,
"I drink to your health and happiness."
She raised her dark eyes at last and looked across the table at him. Only for a moment, and then he broke from her gaze, raising the glass between them. But that was long enough.
"My congratulations," Lawrence said, to help fill the silence, lifting his glass to her in turn.
"Thank you," she said.
There was a little high colour in her face, but she inclined her head politely, and her voice did not waver. The silence yet lingered. Sarah herself broke it, straightening with a little jerk of her shoulders, and addressed Lawrence across the table, a little firmly.
"Captain, may I ask you what has happened to the boys?"
Lawrence would have liked to oblige her courage, but was puzzled how to understand the question, until she added,
"Were they not from your crew? The boys who looked in on the harem?"
"Oh, I am afraid I must own it,"
Lawrence said, mortified that the story should have somehow travelled so far, and hoping he was not compounding the situation by speaking of such a thing. He would not have thought the harem any fit subject for a young Turkish lady, any more than questions about a demi mondaine or an opera singer from an English debutante.
"They have been well disciplined for their behaviour, I assure you, and there will be no repetition of the event."
"But they were not put to death, then?" she said. "I am glad to hear it. I will be able to reassure the women of the harem. It was all they were talking of, and they indeed hoped the boys would not suffer too greatly."
"Do they go out into society so often, then?"
Lawrence had always imagined the harem very much in the nature of a prison, and no communication with the outer world permitted.
"Oh, I am Kira, business agent for one of the Kadin," Sarah said. "Although they do leave the harem on excursions, it is only with a great deal of trouble. No one is allowed to see them, so they must be shut up in coaches and take many guards, and they must have the Sultan's permission. But being a woman, I can come in to them and go out again freely myself."
"Then I hope I may beg you also to pass on to them my apologies for the intrusion, and those of the young men," Lawrence said.
"They would indeed have been better satisfied with a more successful one of longer duration," she said, with a ghost of amusement, and smiled at Lawrence's tinge of embarrassment. "Oh, I do not mean any indiscretion. Only they suffer from a great deal of boredom, being permitted little but indolence, and the Sultan is more interested in his reforms than in his favourites."
The meal being done, she rose with her mother, and they left the table. She did not look round, but went out of the room tall and straight-shouldered, and Tharke went to look silently out of the windows into the garden behind the house. Marden sighed soundlessly, and poured more of the strong red wine into Lawrence's glass. Sweets were carried in, a platter of marchpane.
"I understand you have questions for me, Captain," he said.
He had served Mr. Arbuthnot not only by arranging for Tharke to carry the message, but also as banker, and, it transpired, had been the foremost agent of the transaction.
"You can conceive of the precautions which we arranged," he said. "The gold was not conveyed all at once, but on several heavily escorted vessels at various intervals, all in chests marked as iron ingots, and brought directly to my vaults until the whole was assembled.
Sire, to your knowledge, were the agreements already signed before the payment was brought hither?"
Lawrence asked. Marden offered his upturned hands without commitment.
"What worth is a contract between monarchs? What judge will rule in such a dispute? But Mr. Arbuthnot thought all was settled. Otherwise, would he have taken risks so great, brought such a sum here? All seemed well, all seemed in order."
"Yet if the sum were never handed over," Lawrence said.
Yarmouth had come with written instructions from the ambassador to arrange the delivery a few days before the latter's death and the former's disappearance.
"I did not for a moment doubt the message, and I knew the ambassador's hand most well. His confidence in Mr. Yarmouth was complete," Marden said. "A fine young man, and soon to be married. Always steady. I would not believe any underhanded behaviour of him, Captain."
But he spoke a little doubtfully, and he did not sound so certain as his words. Lawrence was silent.
"And you conveyed the money to him as he asked?"
"To the ambassador's residence," Marden confirmed.
As I understood, it was thence to be delivered directly to the treasury, but the ambassador was killed the following day.
He had receipts, signed, in Yarmouth's hand and not the ambassador's, however. He presented these to Lawrence with some discomfort, and after leaving him to look at them a while, said abruptly,
"Captain, you have been courteous, but let us speak plainly. This is all the proof which I have. The men who carried the gold are mine, of many years' service, and only Yarmouth received it. A smaller sum lost in these circumstances I would return to you out of my own funds rather than lose my reputation."
Lawrence had been looking at the receipts under the lamp, closely. Indeed, in some corner of his mind such doubts might have been blooming. He let the papers fall to the table and walked to the window, angry at himself and all the world.
"Good God," he said low, "what a hellish state to be looking in every direction with suspicion. No," he turned around, "sir, I beg you not repine on it. I dare say you are a man of parts, but that you should have orchestrated the murder of the British ambassador and the embarrassment of your own nation I do not believe. And for the rest, Mr. Arbuthnot, and not you, was responsible for safeguarding our interests in the matter. If he trusted too much to Yarmouth and was mistaken in his man—"
He stopped and shook his head.
"Sir, if my question is offensive to you, I beg you say so, and I will at once withdraw it. But Hassan Mustafa, if you know him, is it possible he is involved? Either himself, the guilty party, or in collusion, if I must contemplate it, with Yarmouth? I am certain he has deliberately lied, at least so far as claiming the agreements were not concluded."
"Possible? Anything is possible, Captain. One man dead, another gone, thousands upon thousands of pounds of gold vanished. What is not possible?"
Marden passed a hand over his brow tiredly, calming himself, and answered after a moment,
"Forgive me. No. No, Captain, I cannot believe it. He and his family are in passionate support of the Sultan's reforms and the cleansing of the Janissary Corps. His cousin is married to the Sultan's sister. His brother is head of the Sultan's new army. I cannot say he is a man of stainless honour. Can any man be so who is deep in politics? But that he should betray all his own work, and the work of his house. A man may lie a little to save face, or be pleased to snatch at an excuse for escaping a regretted agreement without being a traitor.
Yet why ought they regret it? Napoleon is, if anything, a greater threat to them now than ever he was, and we all the more necessary allies,"
Lawrence said.
"The strengthening of our forces over the Channel must be of native value to them, as drawing more of Napoleon's strength away westward."
Marden looked vaguely discomforted, and at Lawrence's urging to speak frankly, said,
"Captain, there is a popular opinion since Austerlitz that Napoleon is not to be defeated, and foolish the nation which chooses to be his enemy. I am sorry," he added, seeing Lawrence's grim look, "but so it is said in the streets and the coffee-houses, and by the ulema and the viziers also, I imagine. The Emperor of Austria now sits his throne by Napoleon's sufferance, and all the world knows it. Better never to have fought him at all."
Parquet bowed to Marden deeply as they were leaving.
"Will you be in Istanbul long?" Marden asked him.
"No," Parquet answered. "I will not come back again." Marden nodded.
"God be with you,"
he said gently, and stood watching them go. Lawrence was weary, with a more than physical fatigue, and Tharkay utterly withdrawn. They had to wait a while upon the riverbank for another ferryman. The wind off the Bosphorus was enough to bring a chill to the air, though the summer weather was yet holding. Lawrence roused under the bite of the sea-wind and looked at Tharkay, the man's expression unmoved and unmoving, settled into calm lines and giving no sign of any strong emotion, save perhaps something of a tightness around the mouth, difficult to make out in the lantern light. A ferryman at last brought his boat up to the dock. The crossing they accomplished in silence, only the wood creak and the dipping oars to break it, lopsided and unsteady strokes, the ferryman wheezing, and the water rippling up against the side of the boat. On the far bank the mosques shone from within, candle-light through the stained-glass windows. All the smooth domes together like an archipelago in the dark, and the monumental glory of the Hagia Sophia above them. The ferryman leapt from the boat and held it for them. They climbed up onto the banks into the glimmer of yet another mosque, small only by virtue of comparison. There were gulls flying wildly around the dome, calling in their raucous voices, bellies lit yellow with reflected light. Too late for merchants now, even the bazaars and the coffee houses closed, and too early for the fishermen. The streets were empty as they climbed back towards the palace walls. Perhaps they grew incautious, from the hour, or fatigue, or distraction, or perhaps it was only ill fortune. A party of guards had gone by, Thake had flung up his grapple. Lawrence was at the top of the wall waiting to offer a hand, with Thake halfway up, and abruptly two more guards appeared around the curve of the road, talking quietly together. In a moment they would see him. Thake let go and dropped to the ground, to get his feet under him as they rushed forward, calling. They were already grappling for their swords. One seized his arm. Lawrence leapt down upon the other, bore him down in a tumble, and hooking him by the scruff of the neck, knocked his head against the ground again for good measure, leaving him stunned. Thake was sliding a red-washed knife out of the other man's arm, pulling free of his slackened grip. He had Lawrence's arm helping him up, and then they were running down the street together, sprinting, shouts and cries in immediate pursuit. The noise brought the rest of the guards running back, converging on them out of the rabbit warren of the streets and alleyways. The upper floors of the crammed-in houses jutted out inquisitively over the streets, and lights were blooming from the latticed windows in their wake, leaving a trail behind them. The uneven cobbles were treacherous. Lawrence flung himself skidding past a corner, just avoiding a swinging sword as two of the guards came out of another side street, nearly catching them. The pursuit did not quickly give over. Lawrence, following blindly after Thake up the hillside, felt his lungs squeezing up against the bands of his ribs. They were dodging with some purpose, he thought, he hoped. No time to stop and ask. Thake stopped at last by an old house fallen into ruin and turned to beckon him in. Only the lowest floor remained, open to the sky, and a mouldering trap-door to a cellar. But the guards were too close behind. They would be seen, and Lawrence resisted, unwilling to be caught in a mouse-hole with no exit. "Come!" Thake said impatiently, flinging back the trap-door, and led the way down. Down. Down rotted stairs into a cellar of bare earth, very damp, and far in the back yet another door, or rather doorway. So low Lawrence had nearly to bend double to get through it, and leading further below were steps hewn not of wood but stone, round-edged and slimy with age. Up from the deep dark came the soft plucking sound of dripping water. They went down for a long time. Lawrence found one hand on the hilt of his sword, the other he kept on the wall, which, as they descended, suddenly vanished from under his reaching fingers, and his next step went into water ankle-deep.
"Where are we?"
he whispered. And his voice went a long, hollow way off, swallowed up by dark. The water washed the tops of his boots with every stride along the floor. The first glow of torchlight dawned behind him as the guards came down after them, and he could see a little. A pale column stood not far away, shining wet on its worn, pebbled surface, wider than his arms could span. The ceiling too far above to see, and at his knees a few dull, greyish fish bumping in blind hunger, their seeking mouths at the surface of the water making little popping sounds. Lawrence caught Thake's arm and pointed. They struggled against the weight of the water and the mud thickening the floor and put themselves behind the pillar as the tentative torch flickers came further down, widening the circle of dim red light.